The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. This weekend, Batman and Superman will face off in multiplexes across America. It will be, as the trailer promises, a classic setup.
The greatest gladiator match in the history of the world. God versus man. Day versus night.
You're psychotic.
And if you choose to side with man over God, that would be Batman. But which Batman? The scrappy guy bent on avenging the death of his parents at the hands of criminals? The smarmy playboy played by Adam West on TV? The brooding Dark Knight who growled his way through the 1990s? In nearly 80 years of fictional life, Batman has reflected the aspirations and anxieties of America's changing culture. He is, as Glenn Weldon observes, a bat-shaped Rorschach inkblot for us to project meaning upon. And among the most influential projectors of bat personality, nerds. Glenn Weldon is an author and panelist on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. His new book is called The Caped Crusade, Batman and the Rise of Nerd Culture, and it charts the evolution of Batman along with the growing influence of nerds on the mainstream. Holy Batman, Glenn, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Virginia. It's great to be here.
So who was the original Batman?
Well, he doesn't look too different from who he is today, but he only lasted about a year. He premiered in 1939, and for about 11 months, he hopped around rooftops of what was then New York City in a bat getup. He was basically a ripoff of The Shadow, the very popular radio and pulp novel character. There were a lot of ripoffs of The Shadow running around comics back then, and he wasn't even the only bat-themed one. But that just made him a very violent Avenger of the Night who basically killed a lot of the folks that he was up against. He developed a reputation very quickly for tossing goons off of roofs to their deaths. That didn't last long, though, because comics were for kids. And as soon as Robin was introduced, about a year later, he fundamentally changed.
So Robin began after the war. So did this lavish millionaire lifestyle. And so later did the introduction of Batgirl. Why was that? What was the perceived appeal of all of those attributes?
Well, as soon as Robin was introduced, and again, he was introduced only about a year afterwards, sales doubled. Because, A, he lightened the tone, and the parents' groups were starting to get worried about Batman. They were starting to get worried that he was killing all these folk. So they introduced Robin to, A, lighten the tone, and, B, to give kids, who were then the primary audience, somebody to identify with. And that doubled sales. It also gave him somebody to kind of work against visually. You know, red and green pops if you're up against a guy who is in very dark clothes. It also turned him from a very violent vigilante into basically a cop in a cape, a very smiling, happy-go-lucky kind of time traveler and space adventurer. Because for about those 30 years after he was introduced, comics were totally for kids. So they introduced all of these other aspects, the Batgirl, the Batape, the Batwoman, the Batdog in the 50s and 60s, because frankly, people were worried about Batman and Robin. They thought something was up between those two guys. And for a period of time in the mid-50s, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Frederick Wortham famously attacked the comic industry for what he saw as its role in fostering juvenile delinquency. And when he testified in front of Congress and in a book that he wrote, he basically said, what's up with Batman and Robin? He said, Superman is kind of a fascist. He said, Wonder Woman looks to me like a lesbian. And there's something going on here between these two men who hang out in this amazingly sumptuously appointed mansion. So as soon as that registered, the publishers of Batman started throwing all these other people into the mix so that instead of being the most famous double act in comics, they became part of an ensemble.
And the ensemble was on full display in the television series. Should I be ashamed to admit that was my Batman, the Adam West Batman, Glenn?
Virginia, it's my Batman, too. I grew up watching reruns of that show, And, you know, there's a lot of nerds, and I talked to plenty of them for this book, who revile that show because it doesn't take Batman seriously, which is the refrain you're going to hear a lot. I argue in the book that that was its whole mission statement was to take Batman seriously. They took the 60s comics, which, again, were not particularly complex and were made for very young children, which had a very simple, implacable, silly approach, and they said, let's put this onto the big screen. Let's just cut and paste it. So we're going to put it onto the television screen, but we're not going to distort it. We're not going to make fun of it. All we're going to do is say, let's just pretend like this is the most serious Ibsen play we are presenting in the world. And doing that made it hilarious, made it funny. That show touches on something very important about this character, which is you can look at Adam West dancing the Batusi on the go-go floor, and you can look at Christian Bale, you know, kind of saying, swear to me, being very brooding, and you can tell that these are the same character. And it's not because of how they're dressed, and it's not because of what they do, it's because of why they do it. The motivation for this character is the key to his appeal, I think.
And also key to that transformation was nerd culture. This is a big part of the book, of course. You admit to being a nerd and a Batman fan, and that's something that came very clear to you when you were lining up to get a collectible Batmobile at Comic-Con in 2013, which I guess was kind of a turning point for you. What happened?
Well, I mean, that's when it was the first Comic-Con I had been to. It is, if you haven't been, it is overwhelming, pleasantly so. I looked around and saw a lot of smiling faces. I saw a lot of my people, but I also saw a lot of kind of cynical exploitation of my people, and you have to kind of come to terms with that. So, yes, I waited in line for an hour and 45 minutes to plunk down $60 for this chunk of extruded plastic that's the form of the 60s Batmobile, because I do feel a very passionate love for that series. That series, the 66 series, turned him into a public joke and was a huge fad. And then in 1970... the makers of Batman comics said, we need to do something. So they created a Batman who was the antithesis of Adam West, a polar opposite. He was mysterious, he was dark, he was brooding. And most importantly, and this is why I think the appeal to nerds is such a huge part of this character, they made him a nerd. They made him obsessed. And the readers of comics at that time were older than they were even 5 years before. They were teens and adults now, before they were kids. And these teens and adults collected their comics, bagged and boarded them, kept them pristine and away from sunlight. And at conventions, they would talk and debate over whose butt could get kicked by whom. And they would pour over this material as, like they were doing Talmudic study. They were obsessed as well. And I argue in the book that there's a resonance there, that we nerds recognize something in Batman that we don't necessarily recognize in other superheroes.
Who is your Batman? Maybe you came to know the Adam West character on television. Maybe you're a big fan of Christian Bale and Michael Keaton and others who played the Dark Knight. We're talking about how Batman as a character has evolved and accepted the projections of our culture, especially nerd culture, with Glenn Weldon. He's an author and NPR pop culture critic. His new book is called The Caped Crusade, Batman and the Rise of Nerd Culture. So you have this burgeoning nerd culture, speaking with each other and creating a culture around Batman, but also influencing the trajectory of Batman that's picked up on by Tim Burton, for example, Christopher Nolan, this dark Batman. How does nerd culture feel about the rest of mainstream catching on, and especially these films? You had some pretty funny notes about what people had to say.
Well, sure. I mean, you can go on to, I found some fanzines back in the day that talked about how nerds were always suspicious of the thing that they loved being taken out of the medium that they loved, the comic book, into another medium, whether that was television or movies. And it's very interesting to see how much Hollywood has learned about nerds. Back in the Tim Burton era and the Joel Schumacher era especially, these directors would come to this material and say, yeah, this is kind of silly. I'm going to dispense with this convention and this convention and this convention. And that engendered a huge backlash. People were up in arms over the casting of Michael Keaton in that Batman film. They wrote in, they had petitions, they came close to boycotting the film. Of course, they didn't, because at the end of the day, what nerds want, what we all want, is validation. The fact that the mainstream accepts this thing means that all of a sudden, this thing that we have prized in our own little way out of the in the darkness at the edges of culture is now as publicly accepted as sports. And that's a new experience for us. So by the time the Christopher Nolan films came around, Hollywood studios had learned their lesson. And they made sure that everybody in that cast and in that crew could quote chapter and verse of which comics that those films drew from. And that made nerds feel very, very protective of the Christopher Nolan films. All of a sudden, they felt like these were ours. And that also leads to the downside of nerd culture, which I do touch on in the book, this toxic aspect of it. When the very first criticism came out of one of the Batman films that was less than a rave, and it wasn't a pan. It was basically just saying, this isn't for me. That guy, that critic, got death threats because nerd culture circled the wagons. So we've gone from being on the outside and critiquing Hollywood to many of us defending Hollywood against the critical establishment.
Well, it's not just the nerds, of course, that are passionate about Batman, but the norms. Many people, as you point out, consider him to be a relatable figure. I mean, he wasn't bit by a radioactive spider. He's a regular human being. He's not a god, which sets him apart from other superheroes. But you also point out that that's kind of ridiculous in a way. Why is that?
Well, I mean, I talk to a lot of nerds, and I heard over and over again that, you know, Superman is entitled. He has these gifts that he had nothing to do with, and he's super powerful, and he can do anything. But Batman's my guy. Batman is human. He's relatable. And I would point out to them politely that he has a superpower that you seem to be overlooking, which is wealth. This unimaginable, vast, limitless wealth, which makes anything possible. It explains away the headquarters, the gadgets, the ride, the costume, everything about him. It works essentially in any given Batman story as magic. And as soon as you acknowledge that, I think you understand this character a little bit better. But I think that there's something about that, Virginia. I think that in America, at least, everybody feels like we could become a billionaire if we just try really hard. So we look at a character like Batman, and the fact that he is separated from us by billions and billions of dollars doesn't necessarily register.
Well, your observation is that the Batman character goes through these cycles of light to dark pretty much generationally, like 30-year cycles. So maybe we're hitting peak grid, and you think it might turn back?
I think that's inevitable. I think, you know, I haven't seen the Zack Snyder Batman vs. Superman film yet, but it certainly seems like he's motivated by the notion of this grim, gritty guy who can beat up folk a lot. And that's a part of him, and that is something that really in the 90s became huge. But there's more to him than that. And the fact that you're seeing DC Comics and a lot of other people making fun of the Batman persona in the Lego movies, Will Arnett plays Batman as a guy who is obsessed with darkness and death metal. The fact that we are now making fun of Batman, not because he's square, as we did in the 60s, but because he is so serious, I think is growth. And I think that is inevitable, that we're about to see a changing of the cycle.
Okay, Glenn, you're going to tell us your pick. You've also written a book about Superman, Batman versus Superman.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. You can look at this on one level as the ultimate jock versus nerd fight, right? Jock has the raw power. Superman's got, you know, the abilities, the strength. Batman has the gadgets, the strategy, the cunning. So in any battle between jock and nerd, I am definitely on Team Nerd.
Glenn Weldon, good to know where you stand. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Glenn Weldon, he's a writer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, The Village Voice, among others. He's also a panelist on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour and author most recently of The Caped Crusade, Batman and the Rise of Nerd Culture. We've got a link to more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, we go from Gotham to Gorham with a new collection of hard-boiled crime stories written by seasoned New England reporters. Dummy up. Murder, Inc. is on the way when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You heard the saying, if it bleeds, it leads. Well, that's kind of the point for a new collection of short stories called Murder, Inc., and that's I-N-K, 13 Tales of New England Newsroom Crime. Dan Chesney is an author, a seasoned journalist, and associate publisher of The Hippo. He's also editor of Murder, Inc., and Dan, great to finally have you on the program.
Oh, thanks for being here.
Oreste D'Arconti is former publisher of The Sun Chronicle from Attleboro, Massachusetts, and a writer of pulp fiction. His story, One Way, Dead End, is just one of the tales in Murder, Inc. Oreste, I am told we can call you Rusty.
That is good.
Dan, this is a collection of pulpy stories about murders and deadlines and mean editors. And at the heart of these stories is the idea that the reporter is kind of obsessive, maybe a little unbalanced. Is that an observation from your long career in journalism?
More than a little unbalanced, yes. The whole idea behind this particular collection was that the line between the reporter and the detective is very, very thin. And the obsession of the hard-boiled detective is very similar to the obsession of the hard-boiled reporter. And sometimes you go over that line, and when you do go over that line, bad things tend to happen.
Yeah, but it must be really fun for reporters who have to, you know, meet deadlines, all about accuracy, fact-checking, to let their freak flag run free.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Doing fiction.
We knew right from the very beginning that we were that this collection was going to see the demise of several publishers, and we weren't disappointed.
Well, Oreste, your story has booze, murder, a heavy drinking protagonist, a dark sense of humor, smart and sexy dame, so sounds like a detective story to me.
Right. Sounds like my life, yeah.
Oh, really? Do you call everyone dames and skirts?
Not usually.
Well, I'd love to have you read a bit from your story to get a sense of the writing style.
Okay.
So you can set up the scene for us. This is at the Chuck, which the locals call the Upchuck.
Yes, yes. It's a sleazy bar. I should preface it by saying when I first started deciding I was going to write a novel of pulp fiction, I had no idea how to do it or where to start, but I knew it would begin in a sleazy bar that I had in mind. And so I did that and wrote on from then, had no idea where it was going, and ended up with three murders and an attempted murder near the end. So I'll just paint a little picture of this bar. Miller, who's the editor, he waved to Missy the barmaid, a jaded loser with tattooed teardrops on her cheek. She opened the Bud Light on the side of the cooler and put it in front of Miller. Nobody used a glass at the Chuck. Getting a clean one was like winning megabucks. I liked the Chuck because there was no jukebox and nobody talked. Everyone just sat there staring into their brown bottles or at the dark TV in the corner that had never worked, watching in their minds old black and white movies about the way they were. Oh, and I lived upstairs. I always said I ended up in the boroughs because I took a wrong turn off Interstate 95. After my marriage went sour, I just needed some space. That space being a desk at the Burroughs Beacon and a reserved stool at the Chuck.
Terrific. Can you walk us through some of that language, that kind of hard-boiled detective language?
Well, I don't know. I guess it comes natural. I've been in the newspaper business probably about 40 years, so I've done just about everything, and did a lot of creative writing, feature stories, and stuff like that. I think you get used to that. Most of the outside creative writing I did prior to this was poetry, actually, and then I thought I'd take a hand at this, you know. And as I said, I was working on a novel. I was up to like 23,000 words when I found out about this anthology. And so I had to cut it down to 8,000. And of course, I'm an editor. I know how to do that, you know. And I boiled it down. It's probably a better story now. But it was three times as long.
Well, there's a funny part of your story where the main character, Randy, he has to do a little social media for a story that he's working on. I mean, otherwise, you could be in 1956 or something like that. Do you find that that digital reality of today's reporter clashes with this smoky, noirish aesthetic?
Well, a little bit, but I think it's just part of the job now. It's pretty normal.
I was going to say, we have a story in here from Mark Arsenal. I believe it's from Mark Arsenal, where the the main three characters are just recently fired from a newspaper that's downsizing. That's a theme, by the way, in the collection as well.
Hmm.
Yeah. And they sit around at a bar, and they're looking for dirt on their on this publisher who just fired them all. And what do? They all whip out their iPads and their cell phones to try to access the internet to get some information. So we're covering both sides of the digital age, I think. Although there is a story in here where we fight Nazis as well.
I did notice that. But it also, it seems like there is a little bit of wistfulness of the good old days of, you know, gumshoe newspaper reporting. Did that become a recurring thing?
Yeah, I think, I can't speak for Rusty. I can speak for myself. One of the challenges for me in getting all these stories and going through them and editing and then picking them out for the collection was that I felt a little wistfulness. You know, I'm not a reporter anymore. I was for 20 years. And it's a difficult, obsessive, takes all of your time, the money stinks kind of job. But man, it can be fun sometimes.
Oh, hey, I agree 100%. reporting is the best job. I'd like to go back to reporting now, even though I've been a publisher. I would love to be a reporter.
I'm talking about Murder, Inc. That's a collection of short stories that kind of take the style of noir pulp fiction and place it squarely in the newsrooms of New England. Stories of murders and bad editors and tough deadlines. And joining me is the editor, Dan Chesney, seasoned journalist in his own right, and Rusty Darconti. He's former publisher of the Sun Chronicle and one of the contributors to the collection. Well, both of you have done the newspaper gig, but done other types of writing as well. So how did newsrooms prepare you for writing for a wider audience, Dan?
Oh, I think newsrooms prepared me for all types of writing, streamlining, editing, making sure every word count, the inverted pyramid, the whole 10 yards for me, especially as in editing. You know, the irony, of course, of editing a collection of newsroom from reporters in New England, most of whom I knew, a lot of whom I'm friends with, was that I had to be a good editor. I had to use my newsroom skills in order to edit the stories and make sure that, you know, I still remained friends with them.
So. You just hit on something, the camaraderie,
yeah.
The sort of camaraderie of the journalists.
Oh, yeah.
How does that play?
Yeah, I imagine it's probably the same with cops and with firemen and with detectives and that whole, after a tough day, you get together at the end of the day. And there's a lot of that fictionalized in the story. At the end of the day, you get together and you just blow off steam. In Rusty's case, it's, you know, his character is blowing off steam in a bar. But there's a lot of bars in this book. So, I think, you know, in order, you get around and you kibitz and you complain about your editors, you complain about your publishers. I think when you're in an industry where you have to work that hard, oftentimes for that little payback, at the end of the day, you just want to get together and kind of release.
So that hard drinking model we have of the reporter on deadline with the scotch in the lower third drawer, true?
Well, I have to say that at one time it was not that uncommon to find a bottle of whiskey in a drawer, but not anymore. You never see that anymore today.
They're not smoking in newsrooms either.
No, they're not doing that either.
I think they get together at the Starbucks now.
Yeah.
So are we going to assume that there's a lot more accuracy in sourcing in all of these hard-boiled Murder, Inc. stories?
I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of these stories come in part from real experiences, yes.
Plaid Swede, which is the publisher of other short story collections along with Murder, Inc. Previously, all the other books are about New Hampshire. There's Live Free or Undead, a book of horror stories, Love Free or Die, Granite State romance stories. So, Dan, what's behind this choice to broaden the scope with Murder, Inc. and include stories from all over the region?
Yeah, well, George Gears himself, in fact, was George your boss at one point? Or were
no,
you
he
his
wasn't.
Boss?
No, but I'm a good friend of George.
Is that the publisher?
Yeah, that's the publisher. George actually knew... There's a lot of stories in here where editors and publishers with the name George meet their untimely ends, and that's not a surprise either, because George is well known around New England media, around the New England newsroom. So when him and I sat down to plot this out, originally we wanted to keep it with the New Hampshire theme, but the more we talked about it, and the more we looked at his and my experiences in New England. The more we thought that we could actually reach out and make this more of a regional book. There's so many reporters and editors and former publishers out there who have these great stories. So why not make it a big deal? Plus, we had the opportunity to release the book at the newspaper convention down in Boston, which is where we had our big release party, and which is where the release party for Volume 2 will be next year as well. So we wanted to jump at that chance.
So George, as often as he's been bumped off, he's going to publish another collection for you?
He's going to continue to be bumped off some more, yes.
Oreste, do you think there's something about New England that lends itself to these kind of pulpy stories? I don't know, the character, the places, the taciturn nature, what?
Certainly New England has a lot of character, and you see that, you know, especially down by me in Attleboro, Mass. You know, the we got Lovecraft right over the border there. You know, you can see his grave. You can retrace his steps. In fact, they just had a Lovecraft walking tour. There's a lot of seamy places, a lot of old factory towns that have a lot of character and have a lot of characters in them.
What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, plus we're all right on top of each other, right? You know, I spent a lot of time in the Midwest, and there's space in between towns. But here you leave one mill town and you enter another. So we all know each other, you know, and especially the newspaper biz. Everybody knows everybody in the newspaper biz. The space between Boston and Manchester is 45 minutes. That's, you know, a quarter of the way across Chicago, right? So New England has a unique place in sort of pulp literature and genre fiction. And a lot of the guys like Damian Runyon and Dashiell Hammett spent time in Boston. I think it's pretty clear and pretty obvious why a series of short stories about murderous newspaper rooms would be birthed in New England.
Oreste D'Arcante, former publisher of the Sun Chronicle in Attleboro, Mass., and a contributor to Murder, Inc., thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Virginia.
And Dan Chesney, he's associate publisher of The Hippo, editor of Murder, Inc., 13 Tales of New England Newsroom Crime. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having us.
On the evening of October 9th, 2012, 19-year-old UNH student Lizzie Marriott left her home in Chester, New Hampshire, to meet up with a coworker in Dover. She was never seen again. For the next 2 years, the tragic circumstances of Lizzie's disappearance dominated the headlines, and details of the case rocked the seacoast.
It was inevitable that Seth Mazzaglia was going to kill.
The defendant and McDonough schemed about how they could exploit her sexually.
And Lizzie Marriott was the perfect victim for him.
Kevin Flynn and Rebecca Lavoie wrote about the Seth Mazzaglia case in Dark Heart, a true story of sex manipulation and murder. Rebecca is also NHPR's digital director. And Rebecca, thanks for coming all this way.
Thank you, Virginia.
And Kevin Flynn, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back.
So refresh our memories. What were Seth Mazzaglia and Catherine McDonough charged with, and what were their respective sentences?
Seth Mazzaglia was charged with first-degree murder. He's alleged to have lured Lizzie Marriott with the help of his girlfriend, Kat McDonough, to his apartment in Dover. They allegedly had designs on convincing Lizzie to join them in a three-way sexual liaison. And when that didn't go as planned, the state says that Seth strangled Lizzie. When he was put on trial, Seth's defense was that Lizzie died during a consensual sex act. And it basically became a he said, she said, because Lizzie's body was never recovered.
And how about Kat McDonough, the girlfriend? What was she charged with?
Well, she got what many people considered a sweetheart deal. She was charged with obstruction of justice and some other minor charges, but they were able to leverage that into her testimony against Seth Mazzaglia. But, you know, when you look at it, really, Kat held all the cards because, again, it was a he said, she said.
And what's interesting is that in the state of New Hampshire, and what a lot of people didn't know, especially people who are watching the case from outside the state, which a lot of people were because it was a sensational trial and Lizzie Marriott was from Massachusetts, is there is no accessory after the fact law in New Hampshire. So even though Kat McDonough admitted that she helped Seth get rid of Lizzie Marriott's body in the Piscataquis River, that's not actually a crime to know somebody that committed a murder, to not report it, and then also to do something to the body. She cannot be charged with murder if the state indeed thinks that she didn't actually commit the act.
Now, you two have written together on several true crime novels about especially local cases. What was it about this case that interested you?
This one in particular was interesting to me because it was less about Seth Mazalia and what he was accused of, and more about his girlfriend, Kat McDonough, who, by all accounts, when she met Seth, was a very normal, you know, well-liked 17-year-old theater girl that was bubbly and vivacious and had friends and had a normal high school student's life. And within a year and a half, she was pushing the body of her friend into the water. And what was that evolution? How does that look when you have somebody who takes that turn in their life?
What was also compelling as a story was there were details that came out about their sex life, a very extreme form of BDSM, mm-hmm. way beyond what many people are familiar with in 50 Shades of Grey. And there was also this other kind of fantasy life in which Seth convinced Kat that they had lived past lives together, that currently there are other personas that they had in this place beyond the veil of existence, and that those characters were affecting things in the real world. And that was part of the manipulation that that she alleged and that the state alleged was how Seth was able to control Kat.
In fact, the name Dark Heart, the name of the book, is one of his aliases. They both had several different sort of characters that they took on in this fantasy world. But neither Kat nor Seth would talk to you for the book. But you were able to really reconstruct their relationship using Facebook messaging largely, which confused me because with everything that's going on, the fight between Apple and the FBI over access to data, this was public record at that point? It was.
And sometimes when we talk about, you know, people in conversation will say, well, you know, will you write about me if I do something horrible? The joke is, well, keep a diary. And in a way, they actually did keep a diary in that they were able to recover all of the instant messaging between the two of them as they're beginning their relationship. This is important because at the time, Kat McDonough is 17 years old, and mom and dad won't let her go out and date a guy who is in his late 20s. So the most of their communication is electronic, and it gives you an unprecedented view of how the relationship begins and evolves, and you can read the manipulation that happens. As adults, looking back, while we read it, it was very clear to us what he was doing. If you're a 17-year-old, it's a little more oblique.
The other thing that's really interesting is that there was more there than I think would have been there in a typical relationship, because Seth, I've really come to believe, whatever his personality disorder is, and there's some debate about this, whether or not he's a narcissist, whether or not he's a sexual sadist, whether or not he has some sort of real personality disorder present, he has a need to basically relive every experience he has later in writing. So unlike other books we've written where the only way we're able to include dialogue is if we interview somebody and ask them what they said, he would say to her what he had said that day on their date, or, you know, they would basically rewrite the whole scene and relive it together in these late night Facebook messages and basically provide us with a complete picture of all of their interactions.
That must really change the game for true crime writers. I mean, we've heard, of course, of Truman Capote sitting there, you know, talking with those charged in the Clutter murders, you know, just eerie stuff. You're combing through this. What's that like?
Well, you know, in the past, we've had varying degrees of cooperation from the accused. I mean, Rebecca's spent a lot of time at the men's prison, probably more so than we'd like
doing
to admit.
Doing interviews.
And, you know, one of the major reasons that Seth and Kat, I'm assuming, did not participate is they're still in legal jeopardy at this point. Seth has an appeal, so it isn't in his best interest, obviously, to talk to some writers. And when it comes to the victim, in this case, Lizzie Marriott, I mean, there's no way to go back and interview them. However, because it's 2016, she left a large digital footprint through social media. So in addition to what people who knew about Lizzie contributed, we were able to get Lizzie in a lot of her own words and her own voice because of the way that she talked about her days on Facebook. And it was actually, you know, probably the best source, you know, first person of a murder victim that we've ever had.
And it took the least toll, I think. I think that, you know, we heard Sarah Koenig talking, I think, on the New Yorker Radio Hour about her,
this is the host of the Serial podcast.
The host of Serial, about how her relationship with Adnan Syed when she was taping season one was in some ways very gratifying as a journalist and in other ways very challenging, because you do have then a person who's incarcerated for a crime that they may or may not have committed, and you're really attached to them for long stretches of time. And when I've previously done in-prison interviews with somebody who had been convicted of a murder for one of our previous books, I can tell you it really does take a toll. Going to the prison takes a toll. Having to think about what you wear to prison takes a toll. Having to sit with somebody whom you know is leaving the table and going back to a cell and forming a relationship with them takes a toll. And I'm not saying that this is better necessarily, but it was certainly easier from the psychic standpoint, I think, as someone who writes a book like this.
We're talking about a 2012 murder case here in New Hampshire that grabbed a lot of headlines, captivated a lot of people. About Lizzie Marriott was the young woman who was murdered. It's a pretty grisly case. And Kevin Flynn and Rebecca Lavoie are with us. They are true crime writers and have written the story called Dark Heart, a true story of sex manipulation and murder. Well, Rebecca, I want to go back to that point of sort of coming to know a murderer. Now, you know the Netflix documentary, of course, Making a Murderer, mm-hmm. that a lot of people were captivated by just around Christmas time. And, you know, the filmmakers, the pair of them, got a lot of criticism for eliminating parts of the story, for only telling a certain part of the story, because they bought into the defense, I think, of the man who was charged with murder and his nephew. So how do you, I mean, you're working together, how do you sort of check each other to make sure that you're representing all sides of a story?
Well, two things. One is whenever you write, you should try to keep it maybe encapsulate it, but keep it accurate and without distortion. Someone said, you know, that it should be like drawing a map. You on the map, you wouldn't have the mountain in full size, but on the map it should be here's the mountain and here's the river and here's the relationship between them. So like all writers, you try to keep all of that in there and just condense it. And yeah, sometimes there are things where you have to make a determination that this interview with this other person isn't as important to the narrative arc as this interview is. So you sometimes make those decisions. And, you know, one of the most compelling parts of the whole story is Kat McDonough herself, because she was the state's star witness. But unlike any trial that we can remember, the question of her ultimate culpability, her honesty on the stand was questioned openly in on social media.
Yeah, I remember
and in
that.
The news
she didn't
coverage.
Cry. She said, I was crying, but there were no tears. I
right,
remember
right.
That.
I can't remember a trial where basically people were suspicious of the state's star witness. Now, this had nothing to do with whether or not people thought Seth was guilty. This was a sort of independent, and this was where the argument came in. Do you believe Kat or do you not believe her?
Well, Kat does really come off as, well, let's say Seth comes off as this kind of sadistic Svengali, you know, who sort of lures in this young woman. So we get a somewhat sympathetic picture of her, I think. But this is the woman who, you know, as you mentioned, pushed the body of her dead friend into the Piscataqua River. And her sentence was pretty light because of a plea deal. How did Lizzie's family feel about that?
They were not happy, obviously. You know, they definitely felt like the laws in New Hampshire let them down, because as Rebecca said there, in this case, there wasn't really a lot that they could charge Kat with based on, you know, what they understood the circumstances of the incident to be. So they were, you know, very disappointed that to the length that she was not just legally culpable, but sort of morally culpable, that she couldn't be held fully accountable. However, at the end, there was some sort of ambivalence because the family did recognize that without Kat's cooperation with authorities, it would be very hard to get a conviction against Seth. And I think there was a quote from Lizzie's dad that, you know, said, if it were not for Seth Mazzaglia, what happened to Kat McDonough would not have happened.
Mm. I don't want to put words in Lizzie's father's mouth either specifically. However, when we did correspond with him, he didn't cooperate for the book fully, but we did have some correspondence with him. And the thing that he said to us was that it was very important to him that we highlight the pattern of domestic abuse in this story, which to me tells me that he understands that Kat was also a victim, you know, at least on some level in this story.
Mm. Well, it's a fascinating case, and I thank you so much for coming in and talking with us about
Thanks.
It.
Thanks. I actually came in. Rebecca was already here.
Thanks, Virginia.
Kevin Flynn and Rebecca Lavoie, co-authors of Dark Heart, A True Story of Sex Manipulation and Murder. They're also co-hosts of the podcast Crime Writers On. You'll find a link to both on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We've spoken to a number of writers today, but mostly we've talked about, well, murder. There are a few murders in The Queen of the Night. That's one of the year's most anticipated novels. But they serve a plot that is intentionally over the top, reflecting the improbably tragic, melodramatic grand operas of old, like the aria from Mozart's The Magic Flute that gives the novel its name. Alexander Chi is the author who dreamed it all up, and he joined us for our 10-minute writer's workshop series and podcast to share the unglamorous process of getting that elegant novel onto the page.
I'm Alexander Chi, and this is the 10-minute writer's workshop.
Alexander Chi, thrilled to speak with you, and wondering for you, who took, I believe, 15 years to write this book, which do you think is harder to write? Is it the first sentence or the last?
Maybe all of the ones in between. The first sentences came very quickly, actually, and it was 15 years between books, but the whole time wasn't spent entirely on this book. I did put it aside for, I would say, 3 or 4 years. What turned out to be part of the writing was finding the first sentence for the novel. The first sentences that you write aren't necessarily the first sentences of the novel. And then, of course, like choosing the last sentence also has this incredible power to it, but then there's so much revision that happens after that.
Do you edit as you go along, or do you wait to the end?
In the writing of this, I definitely edited as I went along. I think, in retrospect, that is a mistake. I think that it's better to write an entire draft, edit it, and then revise from there, and to retype. But I think when you're putting the first draft together, I think it's actually pretty important to just push on through until you have an ending and then figure out what is inside the draft and work from there.
That sounds like a good lesson. Are there other personal lessons or habits that you'd encourage other writers to take up or maybe even avoid to be more productive?
Sure. I had a number of habits and methods that I came up with in the writing of this. One was changing the font on a draft before I printed it up, and the point size and the spacing, so that it looked like something else entirely. There were often times when I would do that, and it was suddenly, you know, made strange to me again, and I was able to see things that were wrong that I had allowed to stay because they were only familiar.
Well, for a book like this of historical fiction, guessing you had to do a lot of research. Did you do that a lot before the start or throughout?
I did a lot of research after the beginning. And in a way, I realized I was writing the novel more than I set out to write the novel. You know, I think that pushing into a novel with your conscious mind where you decide you're going to write it, I think is a little bit of a folly, at least for me. You know, the ideas that I have are ideas that I come down with almost like a sickness. and then the writing of it is the cure.
So what is your personal worst distraction from writing or getting your work done?
Imagining failure. It's, as I tell to my students, you can do two things with your imagination. You'll create two narratives. One will be the one that you can publish, and the other is a private narrative in which you are a failure. And both are incredibly vivid, but only one can take you forward.
So what do you think is the most common mistake that new writers make? Is it imagining that failure?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, it really is the other side of the blade. You have to trust your idea, and if you don't trust the idea, then you have to consider giving it up, or you have to ask yourself, why don't I trust it? What don't I trust about this? You know, sometimes the ideas I see my students have for their work, they say things like, well, I don't want to write a novel. They can choose. And I think, well, if the idea is a novel, then your only obligation is to make it a novel whether you want to write one or not. Otherwise, you should just go work on something else.
I'm wondering if the opposite of imagining failure, having a kind of grandiosity, is also a danger.
Oh, definitely. I think that, and also just a kind of ego-centered wish for the thing to be done. You know, that was also something I would punish myself with. Or, even worse, imagining someone like me but better at finishing the novel than me and what he would have done. You know, these are all these kinds of wicked shadows that we can cast up.
So is there anything that you'd recommend, like books or tools, to encourage people for writing?
Sure. I often send people to Edith Wharton's The Writing of Fiction, which I think is a fine, short, clear, sensible book written by a master at the art. She explains a lot of things that no one ever explained to me when I was studying fiction writing, and her breakdown of the ways of approaching novels and stories both is quite sensible. I really like Charles Baxter's Burning Down the House, a really fine collection of essays about the writing of fiction. I also highly recommend E.M. Forster's Aspects of the Novel. And Janet Frame, the New Zealand writer, she has a wonderful autobiography. It's very long. It's 3 volumes, so it's quite a commitment. But in it, she has a lot of writing process stuff that she talks about. And I learned a lot in there as well about the importance of doing things that seem very almost ridiculously simple, but, you know, like making a list of your characters and a list of the places in the novel and then putting those up where you can see them. So that if you get stuck, you can look at them and your imagination does a kind of multiplication across the items and something can be triggered and you keep working.
What for you is the best environment for writing?
I like wherever I can feel like no one knows how to get me. wherever I would feel just completely forgotten about, you know, is my favorite place. It could be a cafe where I'm not known at all, or a train. And I really also love hotels. Those kinds of environments where it's not a part of my normal life are places where I can encounter myself differently. And then that's usually very valuable for writing.
What's the best piece of advice on writing you ever received?
That's tough. I've had some really great advice. I think the advice that I pass on the most is probably that it is very hard to know what your life looks like to other people. And so when you write about it or when you borrow from it, you have to be very, very careful, because the thing that you are so sure means this may not mean that when it is read by someone else. And I think you need caution when you write autobiographical fiction, caution when you write an autobiographical essay.
If you weren't a writer, do you have another dream job?
Oceanographer.
Interesting.
Definitely. My dad's job. I would just want to, like, basically be on boats and diving and around sea creatures. And I think, you know, also the ocean is easily one of the most important environments that we have to take care of in the near future. It's in a state of emergency.
Alexander Chi, thank you.
Sure.
And that was Alexander Chi for our series and podcast, The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. Thank you for spending some time with Word of Mouth. We like to think of the show as a break from the headlines and the big news of the day, a way to pull back and explore other aspects of our creativity and culture and the stories that bubble up to feed the news. Well, if that works for you, consider casting your vote for NHPR and for Word of Mouth in New Hampshire Magazine's annual Best of Poll. We fall under the shops and services category, and you can find the link there or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or on Twitter @wordofmouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.